Welcome to Inspired Money, the live stream podcast featuring inspiring money stories and inspiring lifestyles. Together, we'll learn to make more, give more, and live more. For an interactive experience, join us live at youtube.com/inspiredmoney.
Someone with excellent credit, what I call perfect credit, being in that kind of 760 to 850 credit scoring range, that person will save or earn over $1 million over his or her lifetime over the person who has poor credit.
Inspired Money is co-created by Runnymede Capital Management and Eagles Vision Creative Collaborative Media Design. We are live in 3, 2, 1.
Aloha, Inspired Money Makers. If you're here for the first time, welcome. If you're returning with us, welcome back to another episode of Inspired Money, the live stream podcast where we invite a panel of experts to help us make the most of our money. I'm your host, Andy Wong, financial advisor. Before going live, we were talking a little bit about our children and proud moments. So I just wanted to take a moment of airtime for a quick share. I am a proud parent this morning. My daughter just passed the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians test. I can't believe it. I've got two high schoolers. I've got a middle schooler. And our incoming high school junior is going to be a volunteer emergency squad member. So very excited that she got her test results this morning and looking forward to all the adventures that that will bring. Today, we're diving into a topic that's super important for your financial health, but doesn't get taught much in school. We're talking about credit. Morris Switzer once said, credit is like a looking glass, which when once sullied by breath, may be wiped clear again, but if once cracked, can never be repaired. Here's the thing, credit can be good and credit can be bad. A good credit score can save you a ton of money on things like interest payments, while bad credit can really cost you in the long run. But managing your credit doesn't have to be overwhelming. In this episode, we're going to break it down for you. We'll cover practical tips to help you build a strong credit foundation, highlight some common mistakes to avoid, and share some real-life stories of people who've turned their credit around. Whether you're looking to improve your score or just want to understand how it all works, we've got plenty of useful info coming your way. So if you want to save money, avoid costly mistakes, and feel more confident about your financial future, stick around. I think we're going to cover a lot of great discussion today. Before we get into it, this episode is brought to you by my financial advisory firm, Runnymede Capital Management. I invited you guys last week to send me a message to my inbox. Not too many people took me up on that. So my inbox thanks you. But I'm going to do the same again today. I do want to hear from you. You can go to inspiredmoney.fm/Andy. Let us know if you need help with your financial planning, 401k or investments, or just send a note to let us know what you think about our live stream format, topics that you'd like to hear in the future. I'd love to hear from you. Let's welcome in our panelists. We've got a great panel today. Let me start with Lynette Calfani-Cox, a friend of the show. She's been on several times. Also known as the Money Coach, Lynette is a personal finance expert, a speaker, author of 15 personal finance books, including the New York Times bestseller, Zero Debt. She's a former Wall Street Journal reporter and CNBC correspondent, and now you can find her everywhere. Lynette, welcome back to Inspired Money.
Thank you. It's great to join you again, especially to talk about credit, one of my favorite things to discuss.
All right. We've got Matt Schultz. He's nationally recognized personal finance expert with over 15 years of experience. He's the chief credit analyst at LendingTree, where he helps consumers make smarter financial decisions. And he's the author of the book, Ask Questions, Save Money, Make More, How to Take Control of Your Financial Life. Matt, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm so glad that you can be here. And then we have a couple of panelists who have also been prior guests on Inspired Money. We have Jerry Detweiler, a well-known credit and small business finance expert with over 30 years experience. She's authored 6 books, I think, testified before Congress, provided reliable financial advice through more than 10,000 answered credit questions and 4,500 media interviews. Jerry, that's a lot.
It is, but this is the most fun. So I'm glad to be here.
We're going to have a credit party. And rounding out our panel today, we have Leslie Tain. She's founder of Tain Law Group. She's a financial attorney with over 20 years of debt relief experience. She specializes in consumer and business debt, negotiating settlements with banks and creditors to help clients avoid bankruptcy. She's the author of Life and Debt and is frequently quoted in major publications and national media. Leslie, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so looking forward to having many different perspectives on what I think is a favorite topic among this group of individuals. Let's jump straight into segment one.
Credit scores are vital in personal finance, affecting loans, rentals, and employment. These scores, derived from credit reports, help lenders evaluate risk. A high score can secure favorable loan terms, while a low score may lead to higher interest rates or denial. Landlords use credit scores to assess reliability in paying rent. A good score can simplify renting, while a poor score might necessitate higher security deposits. Employers, especially for roles requiring financial responsibility, may review credit reports, looking for issues like late payments or high debt. To build and maintain a good credit score, pay bills on time, reduce debt, and check credit reports for errors. Regular monitoring helps track changes and protect against identity theft. Understanding the impact of credit scores on loans, housing, and jobs empowers better financial decisions. By managing credit effectively, individuals can enhance their financial stability and opportunities.
Jerry, if you can kick us off, when it comes to the importance of credit, what advice do you give people just beginning to understand their credit?
Well, I think one thing that I find a lot of people find confusing about credit is this whole idea of what's my real credit score? Where do I get my credit reports? And it is a little bit overwhelming at the beginning. So the first thing I always say is you have to know what's on your credit reports. And to do that, you have to get them. So there is a federally mandated free credit report website, annualcreditreport.com. You go there and you get your reports from Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Now, free credit scores are not required, but there are over 38 places to get your credit scores for free. So then you want to check your credit scores to see what the credit report is saying about you and the way that you pay your bills.
That's a lot of choices. So that's a good start to get our credit report for free. Lynette, in your book, Zero Debt, you discuss the importance of understanding credit as a tool. Can you elaborate on how a deep understanding of credit can really change someone's financial trajectory?
Sure. You referenced Zero Debt, and I appreciate that. And that's the better known one because it's a New York Times bestseller. But I actually have a book called Perfect Credit, Seven Steps to a Great Credit Rating as well. And in that book, my research showed that the difference between a person with good credit, excellent credit that is, and a person with poor credit is phenomenally big. Over a lifetime, someone with excellent credit, what I call perfect credit, being in that kind of 760 to 850 credit scoring range, that person will save or earn over $1 million over his or her lifetime over the person who has poor credit. So we know that there are so many ways in which having a great credit rating works to your advantage financially. You alluded to some of this at the top in terms of, you know, better interest rates, of course, on your mortgage, lower interest rates on your credit cards, your auto loans, your student loans, but then the job aspect as well, and your housing situation. Even if you're a renter and you have a solid, stellar credit rating, more landlords and property owners would be willing to lend to you. And if you have a bad credit history, fewer will. And so you might have to pay a premium for your rent. Or in the job market, we know a lot of companies do employment-based credit screening to determine who to hire and who to promote. So that's yet another reason that you want to keep your credit in tip-top shape.
Wow, $1 million difference. That is like the difference between having a jetpack on your back versus trying to go swimming with like a cinder block.
Way down.
Yeah, right. Matt, I want to ask you, you had credit card debt in your 20s. How did that shape your understanding of credit's role in personal finance?
Oh, man, that shaped everything about my, you know, my growing up and my, you know, going into adulthood. And it really shaped kind of how I view things. And I mean, I think that what it did was it really kind of forced me to learn about credit and about how to kind of do things right and how to pay really close attention to your money. It's like what they used to talk about with my grandparents in the Depression, how it changed them so much. It's what we're seeing with millennials having been scarred by the Great Recession and things like that. When you have those really difficult times, it forces you to really learn more about what mistakes you made, what things you can do better. And that's been really part of my mission in my personal finance work over the last decade plus, is to help people make smarter decisions than I did. Because the truth is, like Lynette really quantified well, there's very little in life that is more expensive than having crummy credit. So it's important for you really early on to get started and do what you can to make it right.
At LendingTree, do you find that consumers generally understand credit scores?
Honestly, no. there's certainly more interest in it, and there's never been more information available on credit. But I really think that people generally tend to overthink credit in a lot of ways. Yes, it's complicated. Yes, there are a lot of nuances. Yes, there are a lot of little things that you can do. But generally speaking, credit comes down to three things. And it is paying your bills on time every single time, keeping your balances as low as possible, and not applying for too much credit too often. If you do those three things over and over and over for years, your credit's going to be just fine. And that stuff is obviously easier said than done, especially with as expensive as life is in 2024. But those should certainly be your goals.
Yeah, I like the way that you put it into simplified terms. Leslie, as a financial attorney, what legal misconceptions do people have about credit scores that you frequently see?
So really from the legal perspective, I can tell you that there is, and I agree with my panelists, that there is a lot of confusion among consumers about credit scoring, credit worthiness, and how that ultimately impacts their debt and financial management. It is common that what we're dealing with on my end are the legal end of things. So after somebody has been delinquent for quite some time and then they're sued, and now how is that going to impact the long and short term values related to the credit scoring models? So, you know, from the consumer perspective, when we're advising them on the legal end of things, that, you know, managing that credit score well early on to avoid getting into the legal ramifications of being behind with debt is ideal, of course. That's not always possible in this world and lifetime. You know, life does happen, and that does get in the way of things, and that can help, that can trip you up as a consumer when it comes to dealing with the finances, and then all of a sudden the credit is mismanaged. So what ends up happening on the legal end is that, you know, we try to advise clients that it is an ongoing, a lifetime process. It's really easy to tank the credit, but it's very difficult to rebuild and keep it consistent. In order to have good credit, you have to manage the debt. So if you have debt that's out of control and there are legal ramifications to that, then that's going to impact ultimately the credit. I mean, there's been changes to the credit scoring models and reporting where certain things are not reported on the credit. And from that perspective, a lot of people think that, well, if it's not on my credit report, then I'm in the clear. But legally, they're not. So just because it's not reported or falls off, that doesn't mean that a judgment isn't still enforceable or that a creditor can't still come after you under certain statute of limitations in certain jurisdictions. So from that legal end of things, you know, we are seeing a lot, the same, again, as my panelists stated, a lot of misconception and misunderstanding on the legal end and how the legalities of debt then ultimately impact the credit piece.
In most cases, are you trying to help your client to avoid bankruptcy and putting a plan into place?
Almost everybody who comes to see me really doesn't want to even hear the word bankruptcy. They really don't want to be in a bankruptcy court and dealing with that. And almost 99% of the time, we can help somebody avoid that just by reframing and restructuring what's going on budget-wise, educating them and helping them see ultimately the what we would call more financial freedom and the fluidity of resolving debt the right way for them. I always say, you know, when you have debt, no two are ever the same. Everybody has a specific, almost like thumbprint of debt. So even if you carry the same creditors, the impact on your credit and finances is always different. So, you know, and ultimately we discuss what somebody's short and long-term goals are. When there's bankruptcy involved from a legal perspective, there are a number of ramifications. And the one thing I do want to say that I find is the biggest misconception related to bankruptcy is that it's a right, but it's not. Many consumers say, you know, I'll just file bankruptcy. You don't have the right to file bankruptcy. You may have the option to file bankruptcy if you qualify. There are qualifying factors that have to be placed, including what's called the means test. And that does change from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, depending on where you live and state laws and federal laws. So not everybody qualifies for bankruptcy. And with many types of jobs, security-related jobs, military-related jobs, and licensing-related jobs, bankruptcy is not an option. So many are coming to us saying, hey, you know, we just do not want to even hear the word bankruptcy. What can we do to avoid that?
Anybody want to chime in? Anything else on this segment?
Yeah, I'd like to quick add that we follow up on what Leslie's saying, and that in those 10,000 questions that I've answered, a lot of people have misconceptions about credit repair. For example, you will find TikTok videos and, you know, different posts saying you legally don't have to pay your debt, right? A collection agency owns the debt, so they legally cannot force you to pay your debt. Please, please, please be careful about taking debt advice just from some random person on the internet, because it could be expensive, because Leslie can tell you that collectors sue and successfully sue consumers all the time. But the other thing I want to point out is related to credit repair. A lot of times when I talk to people about credit repair, we come to the understanding that, Andy, you mentioned your daughter is becoming an ER technician, right? Is that the
EMT?
EMT. And I think about debt triage. Sometimes people come in looking for credit repair when really what they need to do is stabilize their financial situation and their credit situation first. So they need to look at those options, like, you know, whether they can resolve their debts through debt settlement or through bankruptcy or other options, then focus on credit repair. Credit repair isn't always the immediate thing that you want to focus on first.
I would like to just pick up what you said first, Jerry, because I love that you brought this up, that it is very common for consumers to see things on social media and then come in and say to me, well, I was told I don't have to pay my debt, or it's not on my credit report, or, you know, there's so much misinformation out there. It is so important for consumers to understand that just because somebody made a video about it doesn't mean that that applies to you and your situation. The legality is that if your debt is valid, you're legally obligated to pay it. If you don't pay it, they have the right, a collection agency, a debt buyer, anybody has the right to come and sue, who owns that debt legally, to come sue you within the statute of limitations. And that statute of limitations does vary. Just because it's outside the statute of limitations just limits their ability to sue you, but that doesn't limit the ability for them to report it on your credit or continue to collection efforts. It just limits their collection efforts. So at no time should you be listening to somebody who says, who doesn't know your situation or what's happening with your debts, tell you that you legally are not obligated to pay those debts.
Well, I'm so grateful to have this panel of experts and not be confined to 30 or 60 seconds of a TikTok video. Let's go to segment two. We're going to talk about establishing credit.
Building a strong credit score from scratch may require strategic steps. Start with a secured credit card, which requires a deposit as collateral. Using this card responsibly and making timely payments will help establish your credit history. Credit builder loans are designed for those new to credit. The loan amount is held in a savings account while you make regular payments. Once repaid, the funds are released to you, and your payment history is reported to credit bureaus enhancing your credit score. Services that report rent and utility payments to credit bureaus can help build a positive credit history. Experian Boost, for instance, includes utility and telecom payments in your credit report. Becoming an authorized user on a trusted family member's or friend's credit card can also improve your score by reflecting their good payment history on your report. Good credit habits like paying bills on time and monitoring your credit report for accuracy will lay a solid foundation for your financial future.
Lynette, what are some practical steps you took in your own life to build credit since you've been very open about having debt at one point in your life?
Not only did I have debt, back in my early 30s, I had $100,000 in credit card debt before I took 3 years and paid it all off. But I had horrible credit in my 20s. I had late payments, charge-offs, judgments. I had a repossession of my very first car. It was a 19, I won't say what year, blank, Hyundai Excel when I was in college. So I was a hot mess financially from a financial, just a money management and a credit standpoint. It's kind of shocking to me that I was profiled last year on CNBC for being among the 1% of Americans annually who have a perfect 850 FICO credit score. So I went from, 400s-ish, to in the 800s consistently, or certainly, 760 and above, as I tell people all the time, because so many times people just chase a number. And I absolutely did not chase the 850 number. It was just like, oh my God, I got a notice one day. And I have a perfect 850 FICO score. But really, you're not going to get any better loan rates or terms or any better deals financially from having a 770 versus an 810 versus an 839, et cetera. So in my own life, I did not do any of the four things that you outlined at the top of this segment to establish a credit rating. But I love that you included all of those things because so many times people say, I don't like the credit scoring system and credit is just debt anyway. And yes, the credit scoring system is looking at how you've managed your obligations. But increasingly, we do have options for establishing credit that do not require debt. And you outlined them. So secured cards where you put a cash deposit, credit builder loans where, again, you're putting a cash deposit. It's not a traditional form of credit. Piggybacking, becoming listed as an authorized user on someone else's account and you kind of inheriting their solid credit history. And then rent or non-traditional payments, utilities, et cetera, being placed on your credit reports and in turn translating into a higher credit score. None of those things are taken on a traditional loan like a credit card or a mortgage, student loan, and so forth. So in my case, I started off, unfortunately, precisely the wrong way in college, getting credit cards. This was back in the days when they were like, you want a free t-shirt? And I was like, sure. And my motto used to be, hey, if it's free, it's me. I didn't know that free was really costing me quite a bit. So I did that. I had student loans. I had a car payment, as I mentioned, for my Hyundai Excel. And I established credit in the way I think most people kind of do, at least people who are Gen Xers like myself, that we established it through traditional credit means. Again, now you have all of these options to be able to establish credit.
Thanks for sharing your story once again. Gary, do you think that establishing credit today has changed much from when you first started in the industry?
Yeah, I do. And I'm excited about all these options that you just outlined, that Lynette just outlined. There's so many more options now than ever before to establish good credit. And as Lynette mentioned, you don't have to go into debt to do it. So I do want to highlight the one that Lynette just mentioned, the credit builder loan, because some people aren't familiar with this and what it is. So if you're someone who doesn't have a mortgage, maybe rent, you're someone who doesn't have any student loan debt, maybe you don't even have a car, you live in the city, you don't even have a car loan, then you probably don't have what's called an installment loan on your credit report. So that's a loan that has, you know, we borrow a fixed amount of money, you pay it back over a fixed period of time. A credit builder loan can fill that gap and help you establish that reference. And the way you do it is you borrow a savings account. You make payments toward this savings account. And at the end, when it's paid off, that money is all yours. And in fact, with most of them, they're flexible. You can get your money sooner if you need to. But to maximize your credit, you pay over time. And then that's reported to the credit bureaus. So you get the combination of savings plus a good credit reference. And those were not very common, certainly not at the level they are now when I started in this industry.
It's good to have really good options.
Can I add something in here, which I think would probably give viewers a little context, because we've talked about some of the do's and things that you should start to do. Like, I love Matt's very pointed, you know, simple formula. Talk about just do these three things, right? Like paying your bills on time, et cetera, and not, you know, utilizing too much of your credit and so forth. When people are thinking in general about managing their credit wisely, I do think it's helpful to kind of know the rough formulas, whether you're talking about how it is that your FICO score is calculated or your Vantage score, which is an alternative credit score that was developed by the big three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. They're both on the same, you know, scale going up to 850 points. But the gist of it in general, let me just take a stab at the FICO formula. 35% of your FICO score is based on your payment track record. In other words, how well do you pay your bills on time? You know, and if you're doing that, that's like the number one thing that's going to help you to have a high credit rating. 30% is based on the amount of debt that you have outstanding. And credit scoring formulas tend to be most sensitive to credit card debt. And we can talk about perhaps later why that is. 15% of your credit score is based on the length of your credit history. The longer a credit history you have, the more established you are, the more that tends to boost your score. And then the final two factors, because there are five factors, are each about 10%. 10% of your score is attributable to the mix of credit that's shown in your credit files. So I always tell people, all credit is not created equally. So Jerry mentioned installment loans. Generally speaking, you can think about having three different types of credit in that mix of credit. Revolving credit, that's credit card debt. Installment loans, which are things like those credit builder loans or your student loan payments or your auto loan payment. And then mortgage debt, which is just like it sounds, a home loan, a home equity line of credit, and so forth. So that's 10%, the mix of credit in your credit files. And the final 10% is inquiries or new applications for credit. Again, Matt alluded to this and talked about really like, basically don't take on too much credit or only apply for it when you really and truly need it. So I think for a lot of people, if you know the sort of formula that goes into calculating your credit scores, then you can use that knowledge and that information to your advantage and make wise choices. Like when the holidays come up, right? And some nice lady behind the counter says, oh, here, you want 10% off? And you know, okay, the Fed is going to cut interest rates at the end of this year. I'm going to try to buy a new house in 2025. You know, you think you're going to save $10 or 10% off of a $100 purchase. But yeah, you just had an inquiry and that inquiry is going to stay on your credit report for 2 years. And it's going to count against you for the purpose of your FICO score calculation for 1 year. So maybe you shouldn't take that credit card offer that the nice lady at the cash register is kind of offering you. So again, just kind of knowing the formula helps you to make the decisions.
Knowledge is power.
Can I jump in on the trail of that, please?
Sure.
I love the suggestions. I think it's great. I think though, from when I experience consumers and they're dealing with their credit, once things start to slip, the whole thought process of credit scoring and keeping up with the credit is out the window. So as soon as a consumer, in my experience, starts to have challenging paying their bills, they are not necessarily putting credit at the forefront of their thought process. In resolving credit and debt, the credit score actually has to go to the back burner. In order to have that good credit and keep up with it, they have to manage the debt part. I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of misunderstanding about credit scoring models, and even reading the credit report. When a client brings to us the credit report that they get, it, let's say annual credit report or otherwise, they don't have any idea even how to read it. So without understanding how to read it and what trade lines are there and what's accurate and otherwise belongs there or not, I think they have a really hard time in really managing the overall impact of credit and credit scoring models. The models are important, but I think also if you talk to most consumers, they couldn't tell you the three credit bureaus. They couldn't tell you their score, how to get their score, or how to find it. I would love to see more education and information on the basic levels to help consumers really understand this. And I love everybody's books and how they're helping consumers figure this out, because it is so important that they understand how those models work and how it relates to them individually.
That's a great point too, because, and I agree with you, that we do need to do a better job of just giving people the basics. I remember once I was getting questions about, you know, I was referring people to annualcreditreport.com and telling them that this is the federally kind of sanctioned, you know, government website that the big three are required to operate to let people get their free credit reports. But so many people couldn't read the credit report. They would go to annual credit report, and Leslie, you're right. So I remember I wrote this article that literally walked people through that said, here's how to retrieve your credit report, you know, online, and here's how to read it. Because people didn't know things like if they stepped away for a minute, it was going to time out and that they had to click to go to the next one. Okay, now you've got your Experian report, but yeah, you have to go to the next one now to get your Equifax report and so forth. So I hear you on that, Leslie, very much so. And on the fact that, you know, when there's problems, right, if somebody's behind on the bills or in delinquency status, it's kind of like, you know, the mindset has shifted and they absolutely need to think about the debt side first. And it's not about just, oh, let me try to keep a high, you know, high credit rating or try to manage that credit as the forefront in terms of their objectives.
Yeah. I mean, if you're concerned about keeping the lights on and food on the table, your credit score doesn't matter all that much, yep. Right? It's about keeping your priorities straight and making sure that you're putting the effort where the effort is needed the most.
Agreed. And that comes down to really understanding your debt and how your debt really impacts you and the type of debt that you take out. So I thought you brought up another good example when you stated that, you know, going to a store and they're offering you discounts during the holidays and taking on more credit. You know, I have clients that come to me with 23, 27, 35 different credit accounts that we're working on resolving. And you wonder how a consumer can get to a point where they have that many credit accounts. And sometimes it's four from the same bank that are issuing these credit accounts. So, you know, you have to get to a point where you understand there's a limitation to how much you can take on and manage and really be able to effectively resolve.
Matt, can you comment on buy now, pay later, what some of the trends are and how that fits into this discussion?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Buy now, pay later is kind of the big gaping black hole in credit scoring. And that's because for a couple of reasons, partially because the credit bureaus aren't receiving the payment history and all the information from the buy now, pay later lenders that they get from other lenders, but also partly that the credit scoring companies just don't know how this best fits in with credit scoring. Because even though they're playing kind of in the same playground as a lot of other loans, they aren't exactly credit cards. They aren't exactly personal loans. And they have different nuances that make them a little bit of a challenge for credit scoring formulas and for lenders in particular, because if you are a big lender, you want to have as much data as you can on the people you're considering lending to. So that's difficult for lenders, and that kind of brings to the point where it's important for people to understand that the primary customers for credit bureaus and for credit scoring companies are not consumers, they are lenders. Yep. So as much as those bureaus like to keep us happy, the people they really want to keep happy are the big lenders and that sort of thing. So that's partly why this is a big concern. But there's no question that buy now, pay later is a really significant thing out there now. At LendingTree, we do some monthly polling that we call the BNPL tracker, where we ask if people are considering getting a buy now, pay later loan this month. And we've been doing it probably for like 2 years now. And pretty consistently, about a third of consumers every month say they are at least considering getting a buy now, pay later loan in any given month. And so that gives you an indication of the scope of it. But the biggest thing about buy now, pay later really is how easy it is to get. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about being able, like, I think Leslie mentioned having 35 different accounts with, that's one thing with credit cards, but with buy now, pay later, you can do that a little more quickly. Granted, they aren't the long-term debt that credit cards are. They tend to be finite installment loan type things, but still, those are really significant things, and they create a real challenge, especially for people who are just getting started with credit. And while with buy now, pay later, a lot of times you don't have to have a hard credit check, and your good payment history isn't going to get reported, there are cases in which your slip-ups with buy now, pay later do get reported. So in theory, you could have somebody who has no other credit, no other trade lines on their credit report except for missing a buy now, pay later payment. And that's a challenging space. So that's something that a lot of smart people are working on, trying to figure out how this all fits into the general credit scoring space as a whole.
Can I raise the alarm bells a little bit even more sort of loudly around buy now, pay later? And I don't want to come across as the negative Nelly here in the group. Listen, you know, buy now, pay later is a great option for people who are financially healthy, who want, flexibility and, more time to pay, pay in three. And the promise of buy now, pay later is a great one. No interest, not traditional credit. And if you just make those, three payments or so, then you don't have interest to pay on a purchase. Part of the problem, though, for consumers is we know that people often have the very best of intentions, but then life happens, as I say, life be lifing sometimes and all kinds of things come up. And people who anticipate, oh, of course, yes, I'll be able to pay this off, they forget, number one, about how many buy now, pay later accounts that they have. They did it for travel. They did it for retail purchases. They did it for clothing. They did it for household furniture. They were at some store and at the point of sale, or they were online. And the last minute, they said, here, do you want to extend your payments over this? And again, in the consumer's mind, they're like, okay, yeah, I'll be able to pay this off. But then they don't account for the stuff that can go wrong in their lives, like divorce, downsizing, death of a loved one, a breadwinner, somebody in the family gets sick, unexpected bills pop up, et cetera. And so not only are these accounts not being, all the time reported to the credit bureau, so lenders don't have great insight to see how many accounts consumers have, people can get overextended. And if they can't pay, well, guess what's happening in the buy now, pay later space? They're becoming more like traditional credit cards because those buy now, pay later lenders are doing kind of like, and I'm not calling them a payday lender, but they're doing like the payday lenders do when they allow people to roll over those obligations. They're saying, okay, yeah, you can take 6 months, you can take 12 months, you can take you can take 2 years. Well, now you've turned it into a credit card-like product where people are effectively paying interest, you know? And so I'm cautioning people to be aware of, you know, their own financial limits and kind of everything that's going on in their lives, and about the number of buy now, pay later accounts. Matt, I will definitely start looking at LendingTree's data around BNPL. I know Adobe Analytics tracks this, and they found, I forgot what the number was last holiday season. It was something like, and don't quote me 100% on this, but I think it was something like 500 billion or some, it was a huge, huge number of new buy now, pay later accounts and loans that were taken out even just during the holiday shopping season. And my concern is that we've already got credit card debt at over $1 trillion. We've already got, average credit card interest rate at, 25%, 22 to 25%. And so for folks who can't pay the bills, they can't pay the credit cards already, we're seeing delinquencies and default rates rise on that front. What are they doing? This is becoming the new way to borrow. And if a consumer is struggling, now they're just adding to the debt load. It's not just traditional forms of credit like the credit card debt. Now they're adding BNPL to the mixes as well.
Well, and
I'd like one to add to that, if one thing is, I agree. And when I see it on my end, on the debt end, when the consumer is coming to me saying, hey, you know, I have debt, I can't manage it anymore, I need assistance, you know, can you help me work through it? The challenge is that when a consumer is looking at buy now, pay later, it's almost not well thought out. So it's almost something that becomes impulsive versus a well thought out plan on how am I going to buy what I need and pay it off? Does it fit into my budget? Buy now, pay later is often at the end of a shopping cycle on online or other types of products like that. So it becomes not a well thought out financial plan, and it just adds to the ever rising amounts of debt. So if they're unable to pay something off, because we see it. So if you have the money, you're going to pay it off. There's no reason to make payments on something if you theoretically have the money and something is going to cost you interest. Your money is better well spent sitting in a high interest rate savings account versus spending it on something that's going to cost you anywhere from 10 to 30% interest. But with that said, I find that there's a lot of impulsivity with the buy now, pay later, and not as well thought out on those items. And that leads to the challenges. So when finances are not well thought out and the debt plan, the debt management plan and the financial plan isn't thought through, then these buy now, pay laters just trip up that consumer again and they fall further into debt.
And one other quick thing to add, one of the other big issues is that not all buy now, pay later lenders are alike. And the disclosure, there's no consistency and there's no strict regulation in terms of how their terms are disclosed. Like with a credit card, you have to put certain big bold information to where it's easily found. That sort of disclosure doesn't exist quite yet with buy now, pay later, and that just makes it more challenging. Even if you are trying to look and not be impulsive, sometimes that information is hard to find.
Wow. So tread cautiously, because it sounds like a double-edged sword. The ease of access, of being approved, and maybe less of a ding to your credit score, that can be a good thing. But if you're not making smart moves, it can be a very, very bad thing quickly. We're going to move on to segment 3.
Payment history, the most significant element, accounts for 35 to 40% of your credit score. Always pay bills on time, setting up automatic payments to avoid late fees. If you miss a payment, address it promptly. Credit utilization, making up 20 to 30% of your score, reflects how much of your available credit you use. Keep utilization below 30% by maintaining low balances and paying off credit cards regularly. Multiple payments throughout the month can help keep balances low. Credit mix, comprising about 10% of your score, shows your ability to manage various types of credit. The length of your credit history, contributing 15%, depends on the age of your accounts. Keep older accounts open to build a longer credit history. New credit inquiries and accounts, making up about 10%, should be minimized. Apply for new credit sparingly and manage inquiries to avoid lowering your score. By focusing on these factors, you can enhance your credit score and access better financial opportunities.
Jerry, what are the top strategies you recommend for improving a credit score?
Well, one thing I want to point out, and this is a question I get all the time, is credit score fluctuations are normal. VantageScore says that a 20-point credit score fluctuation is not statistically significant. So I'll hear from someone who says, and this just happened with a friend, where she paid off a loan, her credit score dropped. She said, why did my credit score drop? Because I paid off this loan. I said, wait to see what happens next month. And next month, it just normalized. So things like an inquiry, I don't want anyone to think I should never open a new credit account because of inquiries. If you are otherwise doing fine with your credit, that you'll have a little bit of a drop and then it will normalize. So understand that your credit score will move even if you're doing all things right, but you do have to keep track of it. So that's where I do encourage everyone to use a credit monitoring service. Make sure that you're keeping track of it. I myself was a victim of both personal and business identity theft during the pandemic. So, and if I hadn't been monitoring my credit, I wouldn't have caught it right away. So make sure that you're checking your credit score, but don't freak out about little changes in your credit scores because they, unless there's something that isn't right on your credit report, then it's probably just normal fluctuations.
Oh, well, great advice. Matt, any strategies that you see being most effective in improving credit scores quickly for those in need of a boost?
Well, there are a few things, and one of the best things that you can do, and this obviously isn't available to everybody, but if there are mistakes on your credit report that are holding your score down unnecessarily, going and looking and finding those and getting them changed can really make a difference with your credit. That can be a really significant thing. Another thing that people can do, specifically if you're talking about credit cards, is to improve your credit utilization. So your credit utilization is how much debt you have compared to how much available credit you have. So if you have $3,000 in debt and $10,000 in available credit, your utilization is about 30%. And generally the conventional wisdom for years has been that you want to keep it below 30%. But the truth is, the closer that number gets to zero, the better you are. And obviously, the best way to improve your utilization rate is to knock down those balances and get them as close to zero as possible. But we all know that can be a struggle. But it is important to understand that you can also affect the other side of the equation as well with available credit. And you can do that either by applying for a new card, for example. But again, you have to be kind of mindful of the kind of danger that can come with that. But you can also, especially if you have good credit, you can call your current credit card issuer and ask them for a higher credit limit. And LendingTree just did a survey where we found that I think the number is something like 75-80% of people who asked for a higher credit limit were granted one. And I talk about that in my book as well, how to make those sort of requests. And that's obviously the kind of thing that you have to be careful of. If you just see that higher credit limit as a reason to go spend, then you're shooting yourself in the foot. But if you can boost up that available credit while keeping your current debt the same or lowering it, that can have a real impact on your credit score.
Thank you. Leslie, you mentioned that when somebody finds themselves really in trouble, that the credit score is no longer the priority. How do you counsel clients who have made financial mistakes, but maybe they're hesitant to seek professional help?
So first, we try to provide the most supportive and non-judgmental environment. I mean, I've been resolving debt for over 25 years, and I've seen almost every possible scenario related to debt, and I've counseled thousands and thousands of people over the years. So you know, just by really being understanding and encouraging people to seek some assistance, you know, is empowering in and of itself that, you know, while they saw a problem and they took a position to help themselves, I think is a very a position of strength, not a position of weakness. So to me, sometimes it doesn't really matter how they got into debt. You know, it could have been divorce, it could have been bad financial decisions, whatever it is. And there is an air of embarrassment. I would say the common denominator for emotions for clients is embarrassment and shame, sometimes anger, frustration. And all of that, you know, has to be considered, you know, when we're looking at resolving debt. And because resolving debt is not an overnight process, there is no quick fix to fixing debt. It does take a little bit of time. It actually changes habits and it creates better habits. And by offering clients kind of an open door policy that we do where we don't hourly bill or discourage calls, we actually encourage it. We allow clients to call us with decision making. Buy now, pay later. Does that make sense for them? Does it make sense to apply for new credit? Where should they apply? How should they apply? What are better ways to build the credit back up? And the best ways to manage credit and debt along the way. So we're counseling clients on a regular basis who seek assistance in resolving debt the best possible way and encouraging them to be open about the process, fluid about the changes, and be able to understand that, listen, you know what? Many people come to me and they say, you know, for 30 years, I always had great credit. I was always able to pay my bills. I've never been in this position. And you know what? That's a great history to be proud of. And that credit scoring model is meaningful under certain circumstances, but other times it actually isn't. At times when we're looking at clients' credit and debt, and we're looking to resolve the debt, and in terms of the credit, and they're feeling badly about the fact that their credit score has come down, they, you know, we talk to them about what's happening financially. Is the credit score meaningful today, tomorrow, in the next couple of years while we're resolving the debt? And if it's not, and we can hold it off, then we can talk about ways in which we can build that credit back up, put them in a more positive position, create more cash flow, and manage and limit the exposure to debt going forward, and helping the client really make good decisions. And I think that's what differentiates me certainly from other attorneys, and certainly from in the debt world, that, you know, we have such a supportive environment and that there is no shame in having debt. We've all discussed debt. I also had very serious student loan debt when I first started my career. And, you know, it takes time to build up the credit. It takes time to manage and get rid of debt. And it takes time to have the requisite cash flow and understand your habits and ever-changing lifestyle, that all of that has to be considered when we're counseling and we're managing credit and debt issues.
It's a good point. Breaking bad habits and creating good habits, or building good habits. Lynette, I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned in calculating the credit score, I think you mentioned that, like, diversity or diversification. What advice do you give to those trying to improve their credit mix?
One thing I think that people can do to improve the mix of credit that's in their files is to add positive information to their credit reports. So I referenced the three, broadly speaking, the three types of loans that are found on most consumers' credit reports, whether that's a mortgage loan, an installment loan, or revolving credit obligation, like a credit card. So sometimes somebody might not have a credit card, and just like getting a credit card and then adding that trade line or that information to the credit files will actually improve their credit score. But there are other times when they actually did have a traditional loan, but for whatever reason, maybe it was a small lender, maybe it was on their information and dropped off for something, for some reason. Maybe they had an obligation that is current, but is sort of there's misinformation about it. It might say, oh, you have a $10,000 balance and really your balance is $1,000. So there's one extra zero in there or whatever. Matt talked about looking at the credit reports for errors and making sure that that's accurate. That's absolutely important. I think Consumer Federation of America did a study and they found that about 70% of all credit reports have mistakes, a significant number of them big enough in terms of those errors to cause somebody to be declined for credit or to have to pay a higher rate for their credit. So I would start there. And also I would say, don't co-sign for other people, because that can, of course, put you at risk and at jeopardy of having a credit issue if that person doesn't pay. Again, ties back to what Leslie was talking about from a legal standpoint. Some people go, well, it was their loan or they charged it or whatever. Yeah, but you're jointly and individually liable for that obligation, whether it's an ex-spouse or a partner or whatever, or someone else. So be super cautious about co-signing for others.
Well, and when you're talking about co-signing, that also goes for making people an authorized user on a card. And because that's such a common thing now, we did it with my son. And the truth is that the only person who is legally liable for the what is spent on that card, whether it's spent by the main account holder or the authorized user, is the main account holder. So that may make for an awkward conversation across the dinner table with your kid or whoever you're making the authorized user, but you need to make sure that the person who you're giving access to that card knows full well what the consequences are if they go too crazy and don't pay that balance back, because it's better to have that conversation in advance than when the room's on fire.
I also think you can limit the exposure there. I also have given my young adult children access to authorized user cards, but I'm able to limit their exposure. We also, in my house, since they're very young, given what I do, and sometimes they don't love this, but you know, open discussions about credit and debt and budgeting and financial management are just very normal in my household. I understand from my clients and even from the way I grew up, and certainly my generation, money wasn't really talked about. None of this is an easy and comfortable conversation. And sometimes, you know, one person may feel intimidated or uncomfortable, or, you know, it is often a difficult conversation. But I found that having open and honest discussions about credit and debt is really important. What I do find sometimes, and I actually have a client, unfortunately, that co-signed a student loan for a coworker's child. And that person has since disappeared. And now my client is being sued. And so they're very exposed at this point to the legalities of co-signing something. So while you can control credit cards when you're giving an authorized user, if you allow a co-signing circumstance or situation where you're co-signing for a cousin, a friend, a significant other, in any way, shape, or form, you are on the hook and you definitely can be sued. And we see many of those cases. So be aware as the consumer before you agree and do the, you know, my client's a nice guy and he was trying to help his coworker out. But in the end, he's responsible. And you know what the creditor said? I don't care about the other guy who's the co-defendant. I care about your client. He's the one who's working and he can be garnished. So the creditor is chomping at the bit to get to my client because he's the income person on it. The other person's currently not working. So be aware of the consequences and the legalities of setting yourself up in those circumstances. On the credit card side, you could limit that. I limit that all the time with the kids.
and just to be clear, you know, I think the ultimate way to limit that, and I have three kids, I've done the same thing with mine. They're 26, 24, and 18. Added them as authorized users on our credit accounts. But what we do is we get the credit cards delivered here to the house and then put them in the drawer. Like our youngest daughter, she actually does have a credit card with her, but with the others, the way that we handled it is to just keep the credit card. So they're not charging, we're not exposed or anything like that, but it does help them to establish their credit history. One other thing I would say in terms of not having to deal with the student loan issue on the back end. So some things you can kind of mitigate the risk ahead of time, like taking the credit card and putting it in the drawer. But other things, there are options to under normal circumstances, quote unquote, whatever that is. Let's say you're a parent, your kid went to college, you co-signed for student loans. Now the kid has graduated. He or she has a job, but again, you're still on the hook if they don't pay that student loan. You guys could have whatever private side deal you want, but if they don't pay, you're still going to be on the hook. Well, you can get a release form. Sallie Mae and other lenders offer this. Once the student pays typically around 12 months worth of payments, student loan payments, then they will allow the co-signer to be released from that obligation. There's a form you have to fill out and to try to go about it. But
very rare. Very, very rare. I can tell you from my experience in managing student loans for clients, that is very, very rare that they'll give that release. And it is an option. And I'm glad that you brought it up, but it is an option. Going back to the credit card piece, you know, just to touch on what you said in managing the kids, you know, and helping them build their credit. I do think it's a really great tool. All of these things are great tools. The student loans are great tools for managing and building credit as well. But some of the back end pieces that are out there are sometimes in theory and not necessarily in the reality. So if you go in as a cosigner and you think that your student's going to make 12 months of regular payments and you're going to get released, you know, I wouldn't hang my hat on that as the reason why you're going to go in and co-sign a student loan for somebody.
So if you're tuned in, you're listening to Inspired Money, Mastering Credit, Building a Solid Foundation for Financial Health. We're going to move to Myths and Misconceptions, segment 4.
Misunderstandings about credit can hinder financial success. Many people believe checking their own credit report will hurt their score, but this isn't true. Regularly monitoring your credit is wise. Another common myth is that closing old accounts will boost your score, yet it can actually shorten your credit history and increase your credit utilization ratio, negatively impacting your score. People often think higher income guarantees a better credit score, but income isn't considered in credit scoring. It's also a misconception that carrying a balance on credit cards is necessary to build credit. In reality, paying off balances each month is more beneficial. These myths can lead to misguided financial decisions. Knowing the truth helps you manage your credit better. By staying informed and understanding the realities of credit, you can improve your financial health and open up more opportunities. By understanding how credit works, you'll be better equipped to navigate your financial journey with confidence and clarity.
Jerry, how do you suggest consumers differentiate between helpful credit advice and the common myths, since we talked about getting advice from TikTok or online?
Well, first of all, if you are in a financial crisis or you are in a situation where you're not able to keep up with your payments, please get help. There are some great resources out there, ranging all the way from nonprofit credit counselors to attorneys who help consumers with debt, like Leslie and others. So don't feel like you have to go alone. But I would be very, very cautious about taking advice just from someone online, especially if they haven't been in this field for a long time or have worked with consumers over time. So reach out for help and make sure that you're, you know, getting the help that you need. And then the second thing, I would reiterate what Leslie said earlier, and that is the advice needs to apply to you and to your situation. And sometimes it doesn't. So it is common to see advice that maybe that's based on one person's personal experience. That's what happened to them. They didn't pay that bill. And fortunately, they were never sued for it. So and maybe even they wrote a letter saying, don't contact me again, and they didn't get sued. So great. They think that that's the way out of your debt. But that's not necessarily true. So you also need to make sure that you understand, based on where you live and the type of debt you have, you know, what rules apply to you. And again, that's something where talking to someone like a consumer law attorney can be very helpful to help you understand your rights. And also just as importantly, to understand those what if questions that are keeping you up at night. You know, because if you're struggling with debt, there's a good chance you're not sleeping, your health is suffering, you're scared, you're nervous, your relationships may be hurting. And so by getting this advice, you can get the answer to, okay, what if they sue me? What if I can't pay this bill? What's going to happen to me? And a lot of times that alone can start you on the process toward solving the problem.
Lynette, any especially damaging credit myths that you encounter?
Well, I think there are some myths around race, gender, age. You know, people think, I've heard many people in the African-American community, sometimes, you know, jokingly, but kind of half serious, say, oh, well, you know, we're Black, we're dinged automatically, or, you know, our credit score is behind, you know, 100 points just off the top kind of thing. But obviously, credit scoring formulas, again, by federal law, are prohibited from having anything in them that is not predictive in nature. And so things like race, gender, age, those are not part of credit scoring formulas. Now, having said that, I will not dispute some research out there that shows that people's overall situation, you know, can affect their credit standing, and it can be tied to their age, for example, their race, for example. If you live in a community where there is, you know, a shortage of financial institutions and there are no banks or traditional lenders, or you're forced to maintain higher bank deposit balances in order to avoid getting dinged on your checking account or whatever, then your information isn't going to look as good. And, you know, we talk about income not being a factor, but increasingly, I don't know, I'm kind of telling people just watch this space, because I've said for about almost 15 years that every transaction counts, meaning that the credit scoring system, the credit formulas, and lenders, you know, especially in this era of big data and artificial intelligence, they're going to be looking at everything that you're doing and making a decision based on that. So again, it may be the case that even though traditionally a 25-year-old, they're not dinging you, but by definition, because you're only 25, you don't have had as much life experience or time to have established a credit rating as, say, a 50-year-old. So that's why older people, you know, by and large, tend to have higher credit scores. Again, not counting for life and, you know, downsizing, divorce, and all the other things that we've talked about. But just generally speaking, if we're just looking at the attribute of having a longer credit history, yes, the 50-year-old is going to have a longer, typically a longer credit history than, say, the 25-year-old. So, you know, sometimes people make decisions because they go, well, you know, I'm a woman, or I'm single, or, you know, I was married and the credit was all in my spouse's name or whatever, and not knowing that, you know, they can establish credit and kind of, you know, assert and stand on their own 2 feet financially.
Thank you. Leslie, can you give us some insight into legal strategy, how you help clients to resolve their credit problems?
Sure. In terms of legal strategy and resolving credit-related problems, we really have to look at the debt. When we're looking at the debt, we try to understand how is the debt impacting the credit short and long term. Is there too much debt? Is the utilization off? Why is the utilization off? Are they supplementing their regular income by use of revolving credit debt? And that's usually the underlying issue. So cash flow is the biggest issue with consumers that end up with debt, because they don't have enough cash to keep up with their regular expenses. They supplement with credit cards. By supplementing with credit cards, they then start on the minimum payment or minimum payment plus situation, where they're using just a little bit of their budget to pay off the credit cards. But it's almost impossible to pay off debt under those circumstances. So when we're advising them from that perspective and from a legal perspective, we're saying, hey, you know, if we're looking at your credit report, we need to understand why this is being reported and what's happening and why it's happening. It's really great to understand the scoring model, but then you have to backtrack that into the individual and say, okay, you have 20 accounts or you have 10 accounts, they're maxed out. And why are they maxed out? What are you spending on those cards? And what are you really using the cards for? Can we look at the budget and make adjustments to the budget? And where in the budget is it possible? Do you need a supplement of income? Because truthfully, when we see large amounts of credit card debt, we are seeing people who are just simply living off the credit because they do not have enough money, or they've had a loss of income and that's why they've needed to use the credit cards. So without understanding that, backtracking way into the individual circumstances, there's no way to make a plan, a strategy, or otherwise advise somebody appropriately. And that's why when you look at all these videos online, or somebody tells you, you call somebody for help and they say, you should do this and you should do that, without really taking a deep dive into that person's finances and what's going on and where the bleeding is coming from, there's absolutely no way to stop it, resolve it, fix it, and then create a plan for the future.
Thank you. So there's not a one size fits all.
there never is a one size fits all solution to resolving debt, because everybody's debt is different. All of us may have one credit card. All of us may have student loans, but the ability for each of us to pay and how that student loan is impacting our lives is completely different.
Yeah. And it comes down to each of us has a different relationship with money too.
The relationship with money is kind of an interesting dynamic. And a lot of it is how you were brought up with money, what the thought process was, how your parents manage money, the household. And I often counsel clients about that when you're talking to children about money. They're very receptive. They understand your issues with money. They know you cringe when the bills come. They know you know, when you're paying for something in a store, they're observing you, the discussions about money in the household. So, you know, and at times money can be challenging, and it's okay to be challenged with it. But the biggest issue is really that relationship. Is it a love-hate relationship? Is it one you can make friends with your debt and finances? You know, I always look at my debt. I'm a glasses half full person, even though, you know, I'm dealing with such challenges all the time for clients. You know, I enjoy paying my bills. I'm thankful that I can pay my bills. I'm thankful that I've received credit and that these bills have added positivity to my life. So I really have a different relationship with money, debt, and otherwise. And that is something that I also try to teach my clients, that if you go into it with a negative thought process and it's always a problem, it's going to continue to be a problem. So creating that new relationship with money and understanding, and sometimes it just takes somebody like myself who's helping you resolve the debt to see that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that sometimes it's just a different perspective and a lifeline that can really help you change that perspective on dealing with money, debt, finances, so you avoid in the future having to deal and work with somebody like me.
Thank you, Leslie. Matt, are there any like really common credit myths that you find that you're continually trying to dispel at LendingTree?
Yeah, for sure. I think the cockroach of all credit card myths and credit scoring myths is the one about feeling like you have to carry a balance to help your credit score. And it's just really not the case. I mean, there may be random examples here and there where you can find somebody who says, well, I carry a balance and it's helped my score. But by and large, it's just not true. And even any positive impact that you might have or that might have in terms of helping your credit score is going to be negated by you paying interest, especially when credit card interest rates are 25%+ now. And it's just something that people continue to believe. And it's a shame because it's really not doing anything more than costing people money. And the other thing that I wanted to mention in terms of myths is the idea of the having just one credit score and specifically one credit report, because we've talked about how there are three different credit reports available at annualcreditreport.com. And oftentimes people will only get just one of them thinking that they're all going to be the same, but it's absolutely not the case. They can be quite different, and it's really important that you review all three of them to make sure that everything in there looks right, even if you end up needing to get some help kind of figuring out what looks right and what doesn't. And one kind of classic example of this is a tool called Experian Boost, which probably everybody has seen ads for, and it's a really useful thing where it allows you to incorporate some everyday bills into your credit history to boost your score. But generally speaking, that Experian Boost information is only going onto your Experian credit report. And if not necessarily onto the other two credit reports. And that matters because when you are borrowing from a lender, you don't know which credit report of yours that lender is going to pull. So if you use Experian Boost and that credit report gets reviewed, then great. But if that, if a lender that you are trying to borrow from doesn't review that particular credit report, they may not see the benefit of that particular tool. So that's something that can be confusing for folks as well.
Thank you for that nuance. We're going to bring it home and go to our last segment.
Building a strong relationship with your bank or credit union is essential. Use their services and advice to navigate credit products and understand the terms clearly. Avoiding predatory lending is crucial. Predatory lenders often target those with poor credit, offering high-interest loans with hidden fees. Educate yourself about these tactics, read all terms carefully, and seek advice from trusted financial advisors before taking any loan. During financial hardships such as job loss or medical emergencies, proactive communication with creditors can make a difference. Negotiate payment plans or deferments and explore hardship programs that many lenders offer. Debt consolidation and income-driven repayment plans for student loans can also provide relief. Effective credit management includes keeping your credit utilization low, regularly checking your credit report, and maintaining a mix of credit types. Staying informed about changes in credit laws and consumer protections is also important. With these strategies, you can navigate credit challenges and achieve financial stability.
So, Leslie, since you are still with us, before you have to run, I wanted to go to you first and get your comment on this segment.
Sure. So, you know, the credit utilization piece, you know, and building a solid foundation for financial health is really important. And it starts with kind of an open and understanding of everything.
Thank you. Sherry, can you talk about how important it is for consumers to build strong relationships with their financial institutions and how to do that?
Yeah, you know, what really struck me in this segment, Andy, was you talked about predatory lenders, and there's another twist on this, and this is just outright lending scams, where they will target people with bad credit. They may create a website that fakes a legitimate lender, so it looks real, and I can tell you this happened for a financial services company I worked for previously, where they were calling people saying, we're from this website, and we can offer you a loan. And what they do then is they require you to pay an upfront fee that's supposed to either be the first two monthly payments, or it's supposed to be for credit insurance or whatever it is. And then you never get a loan. So you're actually paying money to get a loan because you're desperate for a loan and you don't get a loan and you lose money. So even if it sounds really legit, you have to be extremely careful. And if someone is asking you for money upfront before you get the loan, 99.99%, it's a scam. So do not send money for a loan if you are told that you qualify, regardless of your qualifications, and that you have to pay something up front.
So we're seeing that a lot today in the business sector and merchant cash advances. So merchant cash advances are they're not a loan, but they are a funding product for small businesses with limited or no credit. And many times they're promised that their credit score would be boosted by taking these funding products. They're really easy to get and they require no credit check, but they do require a personal guarantee. So the individual now becomes the personal guarantor of that particular debt, regardless of what happens with their business. And even though it's not consumer protected in any way, it is an interesting product because they become very aggressive. They're all different names that pop up. They're not necessarily banks, and they are focusing on those that have little to no credit, and they're marketing it to those who could try to build their credit. So while I don't want to use the word predatory in any way under the circumstances, theoretically, you could argue that it is predatory, but there are so many people that are so desperate for funding products today because they can't get enough money on a credit card, or they can't qualify for a traditional loan, and or if they go through the SBA, it takes months and months, and you have to have a history in order to be funded money through the SBA under certain products. These type of predatory or these type of funding products become very easy for those that have limited knowledge about credit. most of these people who come to me who've now defaulted on these are being sued. They have frozen bank accounts immediately. They've waived their rights to all different kinds of litigation. They're being sued out of the state that they live in, and they end up with liens against all kinds of assets as a result of defaulting on these type of funding products that promised them that they would end up with good credit. So I also caution very carefully that any funding product that you find online that makes promises like that, that automatically will drop money in your bank account in 24 hours, no credit check, and makes you promises that you will be, you will have credit, is definitely a red flag. And the more desperate you are for money, the more, the greater the risk that you will end up in a situation that will legally cost you tens of thousands of dollars to fix and get out of.
Wow. If it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. One of the things that we haven't talked about, Lynette, we've mentioned the credit reporting agencies. You frequently talk about freezing one's credit to protect against identity theft.
Yeah, unfortunately, identity theft has just, you know, continued to grow over the years. You know, tax-related identity theft, Social Security, identity theft, you know, we've gone from the dumpster diving scams of old where, you know, crooks and con artists would try to get your sensitive financial information out of your trash cans or whatever, to them stealing your information online remotely or accessing your accounts through, nefarious means. So yes, freezing your credit can be one helpful tool in the arsenal for consumers, because in theory, nobody should be able to open a new account if you have frozen your credit. A lender or a creditor would have to contact you first and have you to reveal a certain PIN, a certain number if you do that. So you can freeze your credit, you can unfreeze it. It gives you some flexibility there if you wanted to do that. The only other thing I would say before, as we wrap though, pertaining to this segment about, you know, dealing with banks and financial institutions, is two things. One is sometimes you might think that the institution with whom you've been, you know, doing banking had a credit card, had a mortgage, had your auto loan, et cetera. You might think, well, this is where I'm gonna get the best rates and terms and whatnot. Maybe not. So always shop around. That's number one. And number two, I would say, you should be cautious also about having all of your accounts at one institution. And that's like generally across the board for everything, whether you're doing very well or you're doing poorly. You're doing very well and you might have, you know, cash accounts, you know, significant number amount. You don't want to have above 250,000, you know, in any account, because that's your cap for the FDIC insurance. But also from a credit standpoint, if you have, let's say, a mortgage that you don't pay, a credit card, and you get into trouble, if you have, say, a checking account or a savings account, banks have, at that same institution, banks have what's called the right to set off. And so they can tap into your checking account or your savings and take your money if you haven't paid those credit obligations. So be careful of stuff like that as well.
So on the right of set off, I just want to make a differentiation that the right of set off usually only occurs on loans, not on credit cards. So if you have a credit card account and a mortgage, which, well, let's say Chase, and a car account, none of them are linked to each other. And it is very rare, if ever, that you would see the right of set off. It's different with a credit union, where you would see that from a legal perspective, where they have the right to go into the bank account, because they require the opening of the bank account in order to fund their products and pay their products through that account. But there is generally no right of set off with credit card matters. But that is something that usually you'll see with loans, where they're connected and required. Always save the original documentation. Nobody does. I do, but nobody does. If you save the original documentation when you're taking out loans, just upload it or keep it in an electronic file, because in that, you'll be able to understand whether what the right of set off means, which means that they can go in and take that out. But it's very rare that we see that, again, with the exception of loans.
Thank you. Matt, trends that you're seeing in how lenders are responding to consumers who are struggling with debt, your final thought?
Yeah, lenders generally want to help. That's something that that people don't necessarily understand. And there's a lot of fear, and there's a lot of people have been treated poorly by banks and credit card companies and that sort of thing. But the thing that people need to understand is that banks generally want to keep you as a customer. And if they can help you, even with small things like waiving fees or, you know, clearing up a fraudulent thing during a difficult time, it engenders such goodwill in you that you are likely to stick around and spend more money with them. And that's what any business wants. They want to keep you happy and they want to keep you around. So it can be difficult for people to be vulnerable and to negotiate and to reach out to financial institutions when they're struggling, but it's really important to do so because banks have hardship programs and they have systems set up to help people in short-term financial issues. But chances are you're not going to learn about them unless you pick up the phone and call or send them an email or however you reach out to them. So it's really important if you're struggling and you're not sure how that next payment is going to be made, don't keep it to yourself. Call the issuer and start to work with them.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank our listeners, our viewers for tuning into this marathon episode of Inspired Money. One of the big takeaways from today's episode is just how fluid credit is. It's not set in stone. It's always changing. Your situations can be changing. There can be loss of job. There can be change in marriage or divorce and so many different factors. So I think that it's imperative that you understand your credit and to get your credit report. So that's the call to action today. One actionable step that you can do following this episode: pull up your credit report, give it a thorough review, see if there are any errors or discrepancies. And I want to thank all of our panelists for sharing their time and their insights and their knowledge. Lynette Kalfani-Cox, thanks for coming back on the show once again. You can find The Money Coach at lynettekalfani-cox.com or themoneycoach.net. Matt Schultz, Chief Credit Analyst at LendingTree. You can find him at mattschultz.com. That is without a T. I learned the hard way. Had to make a quick correction yesterday. And thank you to credit and small business finance expert Jerry Detweiler. You can find her at jerrydetweiler.com. And Leslie Tain, founder of Tain Law Group. You can find her at attorney-newyork.com. Thanks. Thank you once again, Inspired Money Makers, for tuning in. As we transition from August to September, we have a couple of great episodes coming up. We're going to have The Mindset of Abundance, Unlocking Your Financial Potential, and The Psychology of Spending, Unraveling the Influences Behind Our Financial Choices. Be sure to tune in for the next live stream next Wednesday, August 28th, 1 p.m. Until next time, do something that scares you, because that's where the magic happens. Thanks, everyone.